Good afternoon. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. As all of you know, I've said this many times, to the great fatigue of some, but not to my own, my goal at the library is simply to make the lions roar. I will not go through the biography of our distinguished panelists today, distinguished readers, distinguished authors, because you will find them in your booklet, in your Penn Festival booklet. It's a great pleasure to be welcoming the Penn World Voices Festival for the fourth time. We've been on board every time, and now with six events today, some of them consecutive, and I feel as though I nearly have the gift of ubiquity. There's so many people to thank. Carol Llewellyn, the director of the Penn World Voices Festival, and of course her whole team, as well on the library side, Kim Irwin and Meg Stemmler and their whole team. After this event, after Michael Ondaatje and Colm McCann will have read and spoken, they will for about as long as a psychoanalytical session, you will have the opportunity of asking some questions. I insist on the word questions. I think you know what I mean. Comments that are 25 or 30 minutes elaborate, perhaps you will withhold for a later occasion. There also will be a book signing. We have 192 books, an independent bookstore. I deeply, dearly believe in independent bookstores. So do come up. Michael Ondaatje and Colm McCann will be signing their books. I would also like to acknowledge Metro Media sponsor. And now I have a little reading to make that Penn has asked me to do. You will have noticed that there's a third empty chair, and here I go. You will notice an empty chair on the stage. This chair represents those artists around the world who have been robbed of their right to freedom of expression, who are prevented from practicing their craft openly or without fear of persecution, and who are unable to join us today. It is a reminder that the silencing of writers in one country robbed the entire world of their voices. This particular chair is dedicated to one of our colleagues currently in prison in China. This year, Penn American Center is conducting an international campaign to win the release of more than three dozen writers and journalists in Chinese prisons before the Olympic Games open in Beijing, roughly 100 days from now. At this event, we remember Kong Youping, internet writer and factory worker, arrested on December 13, 2003, after posting five articles and seven poems on an overseas website that alleged corruption. Kong was sentenced on September 16, 2004, to 15 years in prison for subverting state power, a sentence that was reduced to 10 years on appeal. He is currently being held at Lingyuan City Prison with Ling Yuning Province and is reportedly suffering from high blood pressure and deteriorating eyesight. Please join Penn's efforts to win the release of Kong Youping and all the writers and journalists around the world and in China. Sign the petition at the Penn table outside of many festival events and join Penn as a member to support all of our programs. You can also sign the petition and join Penn online at www.penn.org. And now, reminiscent of a Dylan Thomas book, Adventures in the Skin Trade, Colm McCann and Michael Ondaatje.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be home, home in the New York Public Library. Thank you to everybody. This is an extraordinary week and an extraordinary honor for me to be here with all of you and with Michael Ondaatje. I'm going to read for a short moment, and Michael will read, and then we'll sit on stage and talk. I want to read from a novel called Dancer. With apologies to James Joyce, it's 40 pages without a full stop. And you'll be glad to know that I won't. I'll only do it like a page and a half. I'll do the first page and a half and then the last little paragraph. And the character's name is Victor. He's a friend of Rudolf Nureyev's. So this is from a novel called Dancer, New York, 1975. It's one of those heartless streets you find in parts of the city where the light is still tense with the memory of yesterday's darkness, and even in the late afternoon it already feels like curfew, and the spent trash of the day goes skidding along, and the pigeons sit grey on the chain-link fences, and the traffic is stalled and fume-blowing, and the storefronts are dark and shadowy with filth and grime, 11th Street and C, Lower East, all smack and suicide. But Victor breaks it simply by moving down the sidewalk, making walking into a sort of dancing, beginning in the shoulders with a symmetrical roll that not even the blacks have perfected, one oblong shrug of a shoulder and then the other, as if connected by synaptical cogs, first the left and then the right. But not just the shoulders. The roll moves down into his chest, into his rib cage, through the rest of his body, down to his toes. God made me short so I could blow basketball players without ruining my knees. Then up again to rest for a moment in his hips. Nothing flagrant, no need to bring attention. The walk alone pays homage to his crotch. So if you're sitting on a brownstone stoop, high or hungover or both, you look up through the shit and the grime and the thousand other everyday torments too deep to mention, and you see Victor coming along, looking like he's the first man ever to whistle, in his tight black pants and his neon orange shirt, his black hair swept back, his teeth white underneath his dark mustache, and his body in a role that isn't jazz or funk or foxtrot or disco. It's just pure Victor from head to toe, an art he must have managed since birth, since laughing as he walks, a chuckle that rises high and ends low, a Victor laugh on impulse, like his own body has just told him a little joke about himself. And the whole day slips away from you while you watch him. The clocks stop, the guitars tune themselves in unison, the air conditioners hum like violins, the garbage trucks sound like flutes, and you sit rooted to the steps as Victor waves to the other queens, hanging out the windows, all wigs and feathers and lust, while he crushes a cigarette or ties a shoelace or raps upon a window pane, using a silver dollar so it sounds out, and there are whistles and catcalls. Victor, having become even more famous 6 years ago after the riots in Sheridan Square, when he was arrested for violence and nudity. Yeah, nude violence. But then managed a hand job from a tall blonde cop in the 6th Precinct Station, so Victor was talked about, laughed about, cheered in the bars, baths, back rooms of the city, and he moves on in the empire of himself, taking a bow in front of the windowsills. Victor, having learned every inch of the bow from his good friend Rudy Neveroff, holding the bend, arching his back, sweeping his arm to the sky, frozen a second, grinning, then walking again in the sequence of sun and shadow down to the corner smoke shop, where he hauls deep on a joint with the pretty Puerto Rican boys who polish Victor's shoes with a white bandana, while he goes inside barefoot to tell the shop owner, "Man, they should arrest the mass murderer who gave you that haircut." His own hair so thick and slick it shines under the shop neon, buying himself a packet of Lucky Strikes, his whole life a string of Lucky Strikes, from the streets of Caracas to the cockcrow of the New World, beginning as a carpenter, then a waiter, then a hustler, then a house painter, and after Stonewall, an interior designer. Yeah, I'll design your interior. Taking only enough business to live the way he wants, knowing that the less a man works, the more he's paid. One of the simple rules of New York City. And Victor has, over the years, proved many such simple rules to himself. His favorite being that if you live your life without falling in love, you'll be loved by everyone. One of the great laws of love and fuckery. You take what you can get and you move swiftly away, no looking back, so that even the Puerto Rican boys on the stoop can't hold him after sharing half their joint. He is gone once more, brightening the next street and the next, hailed while shimmying along, the dealers reaching into their tight yellow trousers for a couple of quaaludes, free of charge, saying, "Victor, my man, you tell those blue bloods where the real shit is at." All the dealers hoping for Victor business later that night. Since Victor business is good business, Victor might well guide a large troop to your stoop, so you can wake up tomorrow slung alongside your sweetheart with your heart singing and a fat roll of 20s underneath your pillow, and Victor smiles as he takes the pills, saying, gracias, one of the two Spanish words he uses, gracias and cojones, both of them pronounced in three long syllables, like he's chewing for a moment on the childhood memory of Venezuela, the filth, the dogs, the soccer balls rolling towards the sewer pipes. Thank you.
I'm going to read a bit from Divisadero, and in this scene, the woman Aria is traveling with her son Rafael, and Rafael is one of the minor characters in the book. Actually, everyone's a minor character in this book. So the boy, Rafael's about 11 or 10. Soon they were heading north, returning by a different route, because with the swaying caravan, they needed wider roads. There could be no more shortcuts by simply opening gates and crossing fields, or even fording a stream. They took their time and stopped whenever they wished. Rafael built a fire while Aria coursed over the fields looking for things to eat, an onion or two, rosemary, leeks. Lunch was a collection of minor plants and shoots as if gathered by a pair of birds rushing and diving over the fields. It was barely there on their tongues. When the meal was over, if the stream or river was private enough, they would strip off their clothes and swim. Aria was determined that Rafael never have a fear of water like his father, so she would laugh as she ran down the bank and then grin at him when she surfaced out of the river. She did not want a fearful child. The boy swam into her arms and embraced her, kissed her shoulders. There was a sensuality between them, as there was between the boy and his father in that cuddling affection. Back on dry land, she bowed her head, and he dried her long dark hair with his shirt. Sometimes during their journey, great storms came at night, out of the west, from the ocean. And when they were near west of Saint-Justine, lightning lit up the river like a path through history, and she grabbed the boy to stop him from leaping into its brief beauty. It was a season of storms. She and Rafael kept the caravan in the middle of open fields and let the horses loose. Released, they barely moved, as if pretending that there was nothing dangerous, that it was safer than galloping into darkness. There were evenings when Aria and Rafael stood on the dry night grass with 100 layers of stars above them, uncountable, a million orchestras. The boy could scarcely store the delirious information. That journey south with his mother and the return north broke his heart again and again with happiness. It was when he felt most clearly that there was no distinction between himself and what was beyond him. A tree's sigh or his mother's song could, it seemed, have been generated by his body, just as whatever gesture he made was an act performed by the world around him. They were a few miles north of Plaisance when the eclipse paused over the Gers. The darkness came fast into the afternoon. Rafael was lifting a pail for a nervous horse to drink from and became conscious of the darkness only because it was growing cold. He spun around and saw his mother looking at him with concern. Gray rain started falling in the half light, though it was a wind that bewildered everything, arcing the trees down so they hovered almost parallel to the ground. He saw the horse's eye lolling, distracted in front of him, as if it too were part of this peculiar nature. He didn't know what an eclipse was. He thought it might be some vengeance that came with the end of the world. He was holding the horse's neck, looking for rope to secure the animal, but there was none, so he held onto the mane with his hands. If the horse got loose, they would never find it. When the animal began to pivot, he swung himself onto its back, just as his mother yelled out, "No!" and the horse burst through the trees into further darkness with the boy upon it. Rafael put his head down against the horse's neck, and he became the animal's eyes, witnessing the quick choices of direction. He was saddleless, clinging to the wet-coated creature in the stumbles and swerves until it emerged into a vast field where the sky was a shade lighter than under the trees. The horse now doubled its speed and flung itself into the open. The boy could hear his own breath alongside the breath of the horse. He could hear the hooves in the long grass, their sudden clatter over a wooden bridge after the muted sound of the earth. He was holding onto the warm blood of the animal. For perhaps a minute, time was measureless now. They'd gone through a village where only the two of them moved in the blackness, the boy's leg brushing a cart, then a child. And then they'd come through it, into fields again, beside a river. Then there was a slow return of light, and there was heat once more around them and in the wet grass. Time was in a broken state. The sky appeared filled with bright moonlight, though it was day. The horse calmed, aware now of the fly-like rider whose knees clutched it, the boy's feet bare from another time when they were serene under the trees, and he had approached this animal with a pail of water. Raphael rode back slowly, field after field. They were all new to him. He looked for the village, but whatever community they'd rushed through, he never encountered again. They crossed over the wooden bridge, then saw the black horizon of forest, and soon he could make out his mother pacing on the edge of it. He never hurried the horse. He finally dismounted, lying back and sliding off the slippery wall of the animal. He could hardly stand in front of Aria, though he did, shaken by her, and then embraced.
Great, well done. I could listen to you read all the time. I'm sure everybody is the same way. We call them this sort of adventures in the skin trade. I think, on my part, absolute disclosure here, I have every chapbook, every novel, everything that you've done, and it's been important to me for many, many, many years. And so I'm actually sitting here with one of my great heroes of literature, so it's a wonderful thing to do. And I'd love to go back all the way towards, I'd like to come up to the Divisadero, but mm-hmm. I want to ask you about Buddy Bolden, right, and what happened, and how did you get to an African-American jazz musician in turn of the century New Orleans when you're born in Sri Lanka, went to school in England, and living in Toronto?
Well, you can see I'm very screwed up, you know. I don't know. I think I'm one of those people who kind of, I guess, imagines other lives. You know, I mean, there's always, even now, you know, at my age, I keep thinking, what's my career going to be if I'm not a writer, you know? So, I mean, is it going to be a bomb disposal expert or a jazz musician or a bridge builder, you know? So, I mean, there are all these possibilities. And I think because writing is a world which is very internal and, you know, almost invisible, you know, what exactly happens, we don't know what it is. You are always imagining all these other crafts, I suppose. But jazz was a very important thing to me when I was growing up, and I think that was probably what inspired the book. You know, jazz music has always been central to me, you know, of a certain period anyway.
Right. But and this notion of coming alive in a body not our own, I mean, it's a great privilege, it strikes me, as a writer, to come alive in somebody else's body. But what happens, for example, when you're with Belloc or you're with Buddy and he puts his hands up into the ceiling fan? I mean, when it's not beautiful, when it's tough, when there's that pain, when he goes mad during the parade, for instance?
Well, I think one of the things you do as a writer, and, you know, I think it's there in Dancer too, is you are always stepping into a kind of dangerous territory. You know, you are kind of approaching all your fears in some way. You know, I have a terrible fear of vertigo, but so what do I write about? I write about a bridge builder in Toronto. So, or gunfire. You know, all these things are kind of things I am wary about as well. And I think that's what reason, but that's where I go. That's what I go towards, I think.
But you're not conscious of this beforehand. You're not conscious of this.
No, I mean, I guess what drives me in when I'm writing a book is not, for instance, the overall plot that has been prepared beforehand, which is not the case for me, and I think for you too. But it is character, you know, it's finding someone who you can live with for 4 or 5 years, you know, on the page, and then they meet somebody else, and then you start having a community of people who interact. And the real pleasure of writing is making a portrait of that person in the most complex way, in the most compassionate way, hopefully.
Right.
But also, I think it's learning things. So you are learning about bridge building, you are learning about jazz and the good notes and the bad notes and so forth.
Right. I remember when I wrote Dancer, first of all, I'm Irish, I can't dance, right? That's you know.
I have
Irish men can't dance.
With you.
But so I had to go into this world and try to discover what it was like. So first of all, I tried to intuit it. So I was interested in the sound of dance on the page. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write it on the page before I knew anything about it. So as if there's something like deep in the DNA that we can get at and we can access. And then afterwards, I started going to the ballet studios. I went to the Kirov. I even danced on stage in the Kirov. Mm-hmm. It was very funny. So, a dancer took me down, and there were six beautiful ballerinas in the front row. And he was trying to teach me how to do a pirouette. And there was an old babushka. She was cleaning the aisles at the back of the thing. Mm-hmm. And she just looked up once and looked at me and goes... That was the end of my dance career.
But about the book Dancer, I mean, one of my favorite scenes, I don't even want to know if it's true or not, is the story about... is it Dimitri with the floors? He you know, choreographs the dance by the sound of the floorboards,
yes,
you know, and or the scene, the wonderful scene with the shoemaker. So I think, for me, the portrait of Nureyev kind of gets created from the ground up, literally, you know, from the kind of shoes he wanted or had made for him, or the sound of the floor.
Right.
And I think that's probably why it's a very tactile portrait that you make in that book.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you know, I spend about 3-4 years on a book, so I feel like I go to university. But I know you spend about 6-7 years often on a book, so you not only go to university, you get your PhD as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, except that my research is on a very amateur level. I mean, when I wrote Coming Through Slaughter, I hate to say I was only in New Orleans for about 3 or 4 days.
Really?
Yeah, and I mean, I the collective works of Billy the Kid was a book that I wrote in Canada. I couldn't afford to go to New Mexico, and they're slightly pissed off about that still. Mm-hmm. And the greatest review I got was one Texas review saying, why was a Canadian given the journal's ability the kid to edit? Mm. You know, and I thought, okay, I've convinced them that it was authentic,
right.
You know.
But you deeply researched the tunnel stuff in The Skin of a Lion.
Not as much as the research you did in your book. I think it's almost an imagined situation, and then, you know, if somebody had mentioned the tunnels under the lake in Toronto, and that sentence by itself kind of opened a huge door for me to enter and invent a situation. In the end, I did kind of find old photographs and so forth. I mean, there was very little archival information on that time, you know. The archives in Toronto are mostly to do with, you know, who opened the stadium and so forth, and the amount of concrete that was used. It's not really about who actually built the stuff. So I had to go and went to a multicultural history society, and I found various, you know, bits of data there.
Can I ask you a weird, strange, sort of off-the-wall question?
Oh.
Do you have fun?
Do I have fun writing, or just fun in life?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, that's two very distinct things, right? Perhaps I want to ask you, do you have fun in life first?
Yeah, I have fun in life, yeah.
It's obvious. Yeah. I mean, you can feel it. You feel it off. Do you have fun writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a serious fun. You know, I mean, you're worrying, but at the same time, you are kind of, you know, anything. I mean, the way I write, I allow anything to happen, and I think, you know, I kind of don't have a. I guess because I don't have that kind of path lined up beforehand, which would make it very dutiful that I have to get to these.
That'd
you know, all these stations of the cross before I get to the end.
Yeah.
And I do like the possibility that somebody comes in and kind of throws a glass of milk on you, you know, I mean, under the fictional character, not me.
Right.
And so I think that element is there.
But that moment of surprise when you wake up and you literally are in a body that is not your own. When the phone rings or a child comes in for me and slips a note in under the door, you know, Daddy, let's go play soccer. It's like, hey, I'm a 68-year-old gypsy woman. I can't go play soccer right now.
So what about research that you do? I mean, I know on the last book you did a lot too.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, I tend to be like you in that I like to I don't like to have a map. I have no idea where I'm going. Often I have an idea where I start and a vague idea of how I'm going to finish. But part of the journey is to consent to the fact that I'm going to be cast out at sea for quite a long time, and I'm going to meet sort of distant lands and don't know how the two are going to come together. Often I'll try to write it and intuit it first, mm-hmm. and then go and lay a map on it. So for Dancer, for instance, I wrote all the dance stuff, but then I went to Russia and then hung out, and then I started hanging out in dance studios and watching these beautiful dancers who looked like they looked like wild horses when they're up close, and that musculature and everything is absolutely gorgeous. And then after that, I'd go back and write again, and when it was all said and done, I would have a ballet person read it for me, but I also have them read it to me, because I want to get, or to try to get, the language to exactly reflect what is going on the page, which is where, I mean, your mastery is. I was wondering, as you were reading, do you appear mad to your wife and your loved ones by walking around the house reading aloud to yourself?
I try and avoid that. You know, I have a voice when I'm writing that I can hear it, but it's silent. It's in my head. So if I will prepare for a reading, I will read the passage beforehand and kind of hear it, but it's a totally fictional sound in a way. And I think when I'm writing, I'm very, or rewriting especially, I'm aware of that kind of other thing up here where I can cut and this sounds repetitive or there are too many, you know, gerunds or something like that in there. I'm just wondering, you know, when you approach Nureyev, I mean, I'm very interested in how you actually write about a famous person. And there's a great line of yours, that's why I put this, I'm sorry, I wrote it down here. I always felt that Nureyev was more than able to look after himself. And, you know, I mean, the difficulty is a huge difficulty of writing about someone who's so well known to us. You know, and then perhaps you can also talk about how one writes about artists in a way. But did you have any hesitation about that?
I had no hesitation. The way I got to Nureyev was this. A friend of mine who grew up in Dublin was basically his father used to come home every single night and hit him, beat him and his brothers and sisters up. One night the father came home sober carrying a television set, and they plugged the television set in and they got no reception whatsoever. That night he got the worst beating of his life, right? But 3 days later he plugged in the TV into an extension cord and carried it out onto the balcony of the flats in Dublin, of all places, in the early 1970s, and on came Rudolf Nureyev in this young 7-year-old boy's arms. And I thought, well, that'll never enter the biographies of Nureyev, but it's a beautiful Nureyev story. And my responsibility, which I think I've learned from you and the likes of John Berger and, you know, writers whom I really love and admire, is, I think, to talk about the dark, anonymous corners of human experience and what sort of value that those dark, anonymous corners have. But obviously, intersecting with those dark, anonymous corners, you have these famous lives and these big desires and these big issues. And so for me, I wanted to get at Nureyev by writing about all sorts of quote-unquote small people. And I didn't give a damn about him. No, I didn't care that his friends would look at it and say, well, that's not true. You know, he doesn't have size 8 feet. Mm-hmm. He has size 10 feet or whatever. None of that bothered me, because my responsibility was towards the the shoemakers, right, for instance. Right. And so then what happened in relation to that was that I was liberated. And I didn't feel that I had any responsibility to him whatsoever. Whereas I feel that with my last book, its failing was, and where it lost out was, I felt an enormous cultural responsibility towards the Romani people. And the weight of that history and the weight of that, I feel, sort of dragged me down in many ways. So that having a conscience with a book, I don't know how you feel.
I mean, I think that's very interesting, because I felt very free. I mean, that fun gives you a huge freedom when you write. And I think when I wrote Anil's Ghost, I felt that responsibility very heavily. You know, I mean, it was a fiction. There was a lot of invention, and there was these kind of swerves and so forth. But it was, I couldn't, you know, turn into something, some other kind of, I couldn't leap off the window into the swimming pool or something like that. You know, I couldn't do that. And I think when I finished it, I mean, I'm very proud of that work. But I think when I finished it and began Divisadero, I knew I wasn't going to follow this one path, this one faithful path that those characters moved along. And you know, so maybe Divisadero was a kind of, you know, reflexing, opening up.
Yeah, and I could feel that. And but I would love to go back to Anil's Ghost and how it felt. Did you go back to Sri Lanka, and did you read from it there, and how it felt to go back? And
yeah, I mean, well, I certainly went back when I was working on the book, and you know, talked to a lot of people, and the research was rather similar to yours. It wasn't so much asking people directly, "What did you do in the war, Daddy?" You know, that kind of thing. But it was you know, I spent some time with doctors and traveled with them and lived with them for about, say, a week even, but. I kind of, what I was witnessing was how one lived, as opposed to, in a situation like this, as opposed to interviewing them about, you know, the seven major points about, you know, what to avoid. Right. And I always learn much more that way. But and when I have read from the book in Sri Lanka, but you know, it's a political time that's not very interested in fiction. I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't the book that was going to change. And I sort of knew that. I just sort of wanted to represent.
But
some of those voices.
It changed my perception of Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. and I'm sure for so many of the readers, then it, I mean, because it's such a deeply felt and moving book, and like, mm-hmm. you know, I can just sit here and think of images that trill through my mind: the girl walking across the bridge, you know, the paintings and the statues and the beauty and the putting together of the bodies again, and the like, you know, the brother finding the doctor finding his brother underneath mm-hmm. the sheet, like. One of the things that, you know, I can just, my mind is full of images. When I think of your work, it's just like, it seems like there's like fireworks go off, and I can come back to the moment when I read it, but I can also come back to how it felt to be mm-hmm. sort of disturbed too, because there's a lot of violence in that book as well.
It was the question of how you write about violence, you know, is a problem for me too, because it's, I mean, obviously I have been writing about it a lot. In a kind of in Bill the Kid and even coming through Slaughter, obviously. Mm-hmm. But again, with the stuff in Anil's Ghost, it was because it was such a real, there was so much evidence of that kind of violence, you know, and I think there is a kind of pornography of violence that some writers get into. And I almost subconsciously, what I realized what I was doing was by making Anil a forensic anthropologist, that she was coming to the deaths later. So we don't witness the killing or the slaughter at the time. And I wasn't even aware of what I was doing, but I think that was, for me, the right way to go about it. So you recreate what happened, but you don't kind of see it acted out, which was, I think, a problem for
me. So this thing is felt for you. It seems to me that you live your writing like a poem, that it feels felt. You move your way through, and then you discover a path. You don't decide beforehand that this is how it's going to be.
I think it's very tense until about you know the very last stage of the book. If the structure is going to hold, you know, I think you are sort of discovering what the story is. You're discovering what the emotional situation is. You're the characters are growing in front of you. All these things, and also you are sort of trying to say, well, how do we get this ship made?
Right.
You know, we've got to set sail in 4 years or something like that.
That's right.
And so I think, I think in your work, what I see is that there's this whole, all these variety of forms one can use in a novel. You know, in film, you go into a film and you're stuck with documentary, you're stuck with fiction, you're stuck with a musical comedy. You know, but I think in fiction, you can change gear, you can change tone, etc.
Right.
I mean, the opening of Dancer, with which is a wonderful list of about 3 pages of all the things that are thrown on stage when Nureyev is performing, and then the bookend of that is the at the end with all the
things
antique, you know, left things for sale after his death.
Yeah.
So I mean, stuff like that, I just adore. But then you have to find the right place to put it in. You can have several examples of that, but you have kind of created a structure, you know, that at the beginning and at the end.
I'm interested. I was talking with a German publisher one time, and he met with Cormac McCarthy, and all he wanted to do was talk to Cormac McCarthy about McCarthy's books. But the German publisher's son was there, who was a mathematician, and all McCarthy wanted to do was talk about vectors.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to talk about his books whatsoever. And I meet a lot of writers who are interested in physics, and are interested in mathematics, and they're interested in that sort of symmetry that falls down. Obviously, Divisadero is a book also about symmetry and finding echoes and all these sort of things. Are you interested in did you get an A+ in mathematics?
No, I failed my O-level math.
Well, there you go.
In England. And at the school, that very wise decided I had to take it again and drop English. This was, you know, the English system of education. I mean, the architecture of a book, which is a kind of mathematical issue, fascinates me. You know, I mean, I can spend weeks, well, months, in fact. That goes on all the time during the writing, that, you know, you write all these things down, and then you realize that 30% of those things do not fit the book anymore unless you do something to them. Or, again, as I said, it's finding the right place for it. You know, the opening sequence in Arnold's Ghost, where at a gravesite, appeared much later on in the book, and then I dropped it. But then when I handed the book to friends to read, they said, this book kind of begins at a too fast a pace. We don't know. We don't like her at the beginning and all the stuff. So luckily I found this piece, rewrote it a bit, put it in the front, and then that kind of justified her, you know, showed her empathy, her career. It's just a page and a half, but suddenly that was an okay beginning.
Right. And I did a similar thing with Zoli, in that the last page of the book was originally supposed to be the first page of the book.
Mm.
And so you look and you try to feel these things out, and so you're weighting it up, and then you do have this architecture,
yeah,
this house. But isn't it always scary, because it feels like it's going to collapse in like a house of cards? And I want to ask you, do you still get scared?
Oh yeah, I'm scared until about 3 or 4 months after the book comes out.
Mm.
Yeah. No, seriously, you are worried, you know, and so, you know, because you are hopefully trying to do something you cannot do. You know, I don't want to write Coming Through Slaughter again. I don't want to write Arnold's Ghost again. So you are trying to attempt to do something that you haven't, you know, not quite sure you can handle.
Nathan Englander, the young novelist, said, "The only thing I'm interested in is the inexecutable," which is really interesting, because, you know, we could probably do a lot of things, but you in particular, and some of the writers that we admire together, seem to push the envelope. It's like, how far can I go, and how much can I become the edge, mm-hmm, without falling over the edge?
Yeah, I don't really want to be on the edge. What I would love to do is write a Noel Card comedy. You know,
okay.
Seriously, I would kill for that. You know.
Really?
Because I know I couldn't do it. Mm. You know, so I'm quite safe there, and Noel Card is quite safe too. You know, but there's something that delightful about seeing something. Not a simple thing, but something like a comedy done to perfection. You know, I mean, and I would love. Well, no, I don't know. No, I wouldn't go take that too far.
What about What about Limerick? My wife is terrible. She's not here today, but she's she's the best. But I mean, in a sense that she's funny when she says at parties. She said, "Oh, your husband's a writer." She says, "What's he do?" She says, "Oh, he writes pornographic limericks." And they're all like, "Oh, really? He does?" It's much more interesting than being an ordinary fiction writer, you know.
You're probably gonna publish her very quickly that way.
Yeah. And in terms of form, then, I mean, you've worked obviously in poetry, and you've worked in you've not worked in the short story form.
No, I don't get the short story. I mean, I like reading short stories, but I just don't think I could spend. I think with the characters I kind of have in my books, it takes me so long to kind of get them, you know, that to do that and then have a 8-page story seems to me a kind of, right. You know, it's like that would take 4 years to get the short story. So, because it's really, you know, inventing the character and, you know, modeling him out of clay.
What about screenplays?
Again, I have no interest in screenplays. You know, I think it's such a kind of a form that is so dependent on, first of all, on money and on about 30 other people. You know, and I've seen, you know, friends, Anthony Minghella was a wonderful screenwriter. And I just, even at, you know, at the end of his, you know, life, he was having to rewrite stuff for people who are not as smart as he was.
Right.
You know, so I mean, why do you do that? You know, it's a great art form, obviously, but as Sontag said, it says it's a decadent art form. You know,
talking about art forms, you were talking earlier about maybe reading a small piece about photography.
But it's in the book. It's not really about photography, but I'll read that. And then, you will read one too, right?
Read one. And then I want to make the audience aware that we're going to be open for questions. And what we're going to do is we're going to have a microphone on either side here. And people can go up and ask questions. But to introduce this, can you talk a little bit about Susan and then maybe even Anthony Minghella, I mean Susan Sontag, and her idea about photographs?
I actually have never read her book on photographs, so I can't talk about that. But about Minghella I can talk about in the sense that he actually was, he was very much a writer, you know, and when I worked with him, and he was always conscious of poetry. He's someone who, you know, he was a playwright first of all, so that was almost this awareness of what was the delight about him was he was like talking and working with a writer, you know, more than a filmmaker.
Did he ever write fiction?
He was hoping to.
Must have broken your heart when he passed away.
Yeah.
He passed away how long ago?
Just a couple of months, about a month ago, 2 months ago. This bit is actually the only bit where the two main stories link up very scarcely. I mean, they link up profoundly in other ways, but this is one little moment. And Anna is one of the characters in the first part of the story, and then the second part of the story is about this French writer called Lucien Segura, who is sort of created or invented, or his life or his biography is written by Anna, and it reflects a lot of her life. And this is just a page and a half of a thing called Two Photographs. And Anna has met Raphael, who we saw as a boy in the earlier section I read, now an adult. There are two photographs pinned up on the wall of the kitchen. One is a picture taken of Lucien Segura in his last phase of his life, sitting on the garden bench with a dark branch fanning out above him. There is a sense of formality as well as disorder in the picture. And the disorder comes from the appearance of the writer, his unironed shirt, his mustache, which looks like something borrowed from an animal. Though what is most informal is the openness of his face, as if it had just been blessed. His laugh, for instance, there was no attempt to hide the shaggy randomness or even the unsightly gap of a missing tooth. This was a discreet man who used to laugh internally in a hidden way. On the right-hand side of the picture is a dark blur, something unknown, like raw paint imposed on an otherwise immaculate canvas. Or perhaps it is a bat in the daylight, caught flying between camera and writer. This is the only photographic capturing of Lucien's friend Astolphe, who turned on the photographer with a surprising belligerence when he heard the shutter begin to slip into place, turning so quickly that he was able to dissolve his appearance. The other picture, taken on the same grounds, was snapped all these years later by the belligerent and blurred subject's son, Raphael. It is of the woman he met in the writer's house. He used her camera, and the image has been blown up to the same size as the other, so it is, in a way, a partner to it. We are here closer to the subject in this picture. Photography has moved in from the middle distance as the century progressed, illuminating vistas, the great forests, the ranging hills. The woman's figure is naked from the waist up, moving forward, just about to break free of focus. The tanned body willful, laughing, because she has woven the roots of two small muddy plants into her blonde hair, so it appears as if mullein and rosemary are growing out of the plastered earth on her head. There's a wet muck around her smiling mouth and on her lean shoulders and arms. It is as if her energy and sensuality have been drawn from the air surrounding her. We look at this picture and imagine also the person and the camera walking backwards at the same pace as the subject so that she remains in focus. We can guess the relationship between the unseen photographer and this laughing, muddy woman weeds around the fingers of her hand, gesturing to him in intimate, argumentative pleasure. This woman who is barely Anna.
Wow.
I'm sitting here smiling because I'm remembering the pleasure of reading that moment, and the pleasure in general of walking into the photographs that you create. In other words, I sometimes feel like a little bit of a ghost on the outside of your pages, and you create a photograph for me, cinematographically, or maybe just photographically, and I can then just sort of lower myself into the background of that photograph or that painting, and that seems to me to be an enormous privilege for a reader, because you never actually tell us how to think, but you allow us to feel the most extraordinary way. And I also remember you reading about you saying that you like to be about 5 or 6 pages ahead of the reader.
Yeah, just ahead of the reader, I think. You know, I really don't want to know. I don't want to control the scene I'm in when I'm writing, I think. You know, and I get that sense in you too, that you know that anything could happen, that could kind of collapse, and it's almost like why you don't take it in advance, you know, because if what you're going to work on doesn't, you know. If it collapses and embarrasses you, then you're stuck with giving it to someone whose money you've taken, you know. So, I mean, I think there's that element. And there's that adventure that you want to be allowed to have, you know. Ornette Coleman has this great line, what you play at the beginning is the territory, and what follows is the adventure. And I think, you know, it's almost like what you've done, you know, in all your books, even with the opening of the new one, where you have it's about 2003 or something like that, and then you jump back in history. So you create a kind of, you know, tableau, and then you kind of break into it and go backwards.
That's right. I will read that little piece.
Please do.
I'm going to read just a tiny piece from the point of view of an elderly Russian man whose wife has taught Rudolf Nureyev how to dance when he's at the age of 11. And then after this, we'll maybe open it up for questions. This is a page and a half. So Rudolf Nureyev has been to their house as a boy. And after the boy left, Anna put on her nightgown, worn at the elbows, and she perched at the very edge of the bed. I was at my desk reading. She whispered goodnight, but then she coughed and said she felt blessed, that it was enough in this life just to feel blessed from time to time. She said she knew, even after just one session, that the boy could be something unusual. She rose and shuffled across the room, put her arms to my shoulders, With one hand, she removed my reading glasses. She placed them in the center spine of the book, and she turned my face to hers. She said my name, and it pierced my fatigue in the most extraordinary way. As she leaned across, her hair brushed against me, and it smelled like the days when she'd been with Mariinsky. She turned me sideways in the chair, and the light from the candle flickered on her face. She said, "Read to me, husband." I picked up the book, and she said, "No, not here. Let's go to bed." It was a book of Pasternak's that had survived all our years, open to a poem about stars frozen in the sky. I have always adored Pasternak, not just for the obvious reasons, but because it has seemed to me that by staying in the rear guard rather than moving with the vanguard, he had learned to love what is left behind without mourning what was gone. The book was fattened from being thumbed through so much. My habit, which Anna hated, of turning down the edges of my favorite pages gave it a further thickness. I picked up the candle, the book, my glasses, and I stepped to the bed, pulled back the covers, got in. Anna dropped her wooden dentures on a plate with a little sigh, combed her hair, climbed in beside me. Her feet were cold as always. With older dancers, it's often this way. Having tortured their feet for so many years, the blood just refuses to journey. I read to her from a cycle of nature poems until she fell asleep, and it didn't seem indulgent to let my arm fall across her waist while she slept to take a little of her happiness. The old steal from each other as much as the young do, but perhaps our thefts are more necessary. In years gone by, Anna and I have stolen from each other ferociously and then lived inside the stolen moments until we began to share them. She once told me that when I was incarcerated, she turned down my covers, even rolled across and made a dent in the pillow as if I was still there. I read more Pasternak as she slept and then quoted it from memory when the candle burned all the way down. Her breath grew foul and I leaned in against her, pulled the covers high. Her hair had loosened and it fell across her face, and with a little breeze from the open window, the strands crossed and recrossed her eyes. Sentiment is foolish, of course, and I do not know whether I slept that night, but I do remember thinking a very simple thought, that despite all the years, I was still in love with her, and at that moment, it didn't seem foolish at all to have loved her or to go on loving her, even in all our wreckage. So, I don't know, can you see out? I can't see out.
There's a mic right there.
Just
go back.
Oh, there's a mic. Where is the mic?
Or we could yell. We could repeat the question.
We need sunglasses. Oh, there's the mic, okay.
In the process of writing a novel or a fiction, does it sometimes occur that one of the characters refuses to come alive, escapes you? Do you then drop the character?
For me, I would probably keep the character somewhere around, you know. Maybe I'll deal with him in the next novel, you know. It would intrigue me if there was a character like that. And, you know, the other characters would probably discuss that problem, you know. I think I've got quite a few of those kind of characters in my books already, you know. There's a kind of, even the father of Raphael in this book is kind of very secretive, you know, and he keeps changing his name the whole time and trying to evolve into somebody else. So I'd probably welcome that kind of person. I would certainly keep him around anyway.
What about you?
Yeah, and that's the sort of person I'm sort of very much attracted to. I will say this, that when I was writing Zoli, I was about 2.5 years into the project, and she left me. She just left. And I was in grief, and I don't suppose it's fairly embarrassing, but yeah, I gave up on it, And I was in tears, and I spent about 2 or 3 weeks that way, having basically lost what I felt was 2.5 years of my life, because she wouldn't come back. She just wasn't there. I couldn't get her.
And then
she came back, and then she said, it was almost like she said, I wanted you to feel that experience of being exiled, of being completely gone, of being right out there, just even just for a very, very brief time. And then she came back, and then she allowed me to sort of finish it. And even though, as I said, I feel that book is a failure in many ways, I love her deeply, and of all the characters I've ever created, she's the one I would go back to and spend the most time with, precisely because of this lady's fabulous question, because she is an enigma still.
I mean, I think it's kind of interesting when you leave a character unfinished. You know, this can irritate the reader, obviously, as some have been irritated by the Visadero, but I think if they leave or something happens to them or their story is unfinished, what happens is that color starts appearing in the other people around her or him in some way.
Mr. Ondaatje, oh, sorry. Mr. Ondaatje, I wanted to ask you about the collected works of Billy the Kid, the left-handed poems, which was truly an experience to read because it breaks so many forms. And I just wonder if you feel that you would want to try another work like that. And then, do you want literature to change? And in that way, do you want things to change? Or what is your feeling on breaking forms in literature?
Well, I don't kind of intentionally want to be an experimental writer or go out and, you know, blow up the literary forms of fiction and stuff like that. But I just find that, you know, when we talk about fiction, we become very conservative, you know, in terms of what a novel is. You know, if you read someone like Kawabata in the 20s and 30s, he's doing much more working with fact and fiction and so forth than someone like, Norman Mailer or someone did much later on. I think it's just that I'm a bit bored with the very strict form of what the novel is that we seem to perceive in our heads. That so that, you know, 20th century painting has kind of gone through all kinds of, you know, radical movements, and music has gone through all kinds of radical movements. But I think that the novel has remained a rather staid form. I have no desire to. I think the novel is such a bag of all kinds of nails and asparagus and everything, you know. So it's you know, it can allow anything into it. As long as you have some kind of shape that holds it together, you know, and that could be an organic form or something else, but not the usual Mickey Spillane form, perhaps.
For those who've read Coming Through Slaughter, I'm just reminded of that line that's in the middle of the page, passing wet fields like chicory in the sky, passing wet fields like chicory in the sky. And that sort of thing comes in, and it's absolutely part of the novel because it has all that jazz rhythm as well.
Yeah.
But do you think that, like, form gets dictated by content?
I think, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, very much so. I think, you know, so every book has to find a new form. You know, I mean, that's why when you asked about Billy the Kid, I mean, that was the only way I could write that book, but I wouldn't want to go back and write a book in that form. You know, that belonged only to that story. And I think every book, you know, I had no idea De Visadero was going to be this divisive, you know. I think it's, you know, that's why the structure is always, you know, fascinating. It's part
I love the structure of that book. I love the structure of De Visadero, but it has caused critics and readers alike to
readers have been more polite, perhaps.
Thank you for the wonderful conversation. I just have a question for Mr. Ondaatje.
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with your work, but since we're on the topic of freedom of expression and you're from Sri Lanka, have you ever done or considered working on a work that reflects the current political struggle in Sri Lanka between the Tamilese Tigers, Tamil Tigers and the Sinhalese government?
Well, I did write that book, Anil's Ghost, which does sort of deal with that, some of that, you know, not everything. You know, the problem is, if you approach a subject, a very big subject like this, you cannot write everything about it. You know, you have to kind of, a novel, if you're writing a novel, that is, you have to kind of have a kind of, give yourself just one kind of slice of the issue, you know, in some ways. There's a huge difference between a fiction writer and the reality. And the fiction writer has to find his or her own form or pattern for the story. So that book is my pattern for what, it's of an earlier time, but a lot of it is that you're talking about is in that book, I think.
Thanks for a wonderful conversation. This is a question for Ondaatje, but I'm hoping both of you can speak to it. I'm fascinated by the relationship between fact and fiction in your books, the way that you'll often take an actual person or event from history, but then explore it through these vivid, poetic documentaries that always at some level stay tentative and provisional. I think it was Frank Davey talking about the Canadian long poem form. He talked about the temptation to the documentary, but the distrust of history, and therefore always a madness in the recording. And I was wondering if you could talk about that tension or dynamic in your work.
Well, very quickly, in Canada, you know, our film industry was sort of co-opted by and taken over by American film industry. So we got known as documentary filmmakers for a long time, you know, and so, but the documentary, the document has always been a very important part of Canadian art, and also poetry. I think that's what happened. Perhaps you could answer this question. I'm going to cough.
Sorry. I think there's something deeply political going on here. I know this has been going on for a long time, but you see a lot of contemporary fiction, you know, taking like Colm Tabin, Michael Cunningham, you know, taking, you know, contemporary figures. And so why is this happening and what's going on and what are they questioning? Well, William Maxwell talks about, you know, in talking about the past, we lie with every breath that we draw, and that a writer's responsibility is not to the facts, but to the texture of the facts. But I remember Colin Powell getting up there 5 years ago and saying, this is a photograph, right? Therefore, it's a fact, right? I'm holding in my hand a fact, and it's a chemical tanker. Therefore, extrapolate from that, people, the other fact that they have chemical weapons that sent our children to war, or our, you know, our brothers and sisters to war. And they took from those facts and they created a fiction out of them. And I think in many ways, a lot of writers are so outraged, and a lot of people are so outraged about what has been done to the notion of fact, that they say that we can go in and we can create a fiction out of them, and if the true texture of the truth comes in, we would not have allowed Colin Powell to stand up there and the rest of that government to go off and to ship soldiers out from this country and to engage in what I feel personally was a wrongful war.
Hi. What you just spoke to really reminded me of, I think, what John Dufresne called the lie that tells the truth in a lot of fiction. But my question has to do with process for both of you, because in both of your work, there's such vivid imagery along with emotional resonance. And I guess that speaks to the poetic impulse, but I'm wondering, as you write, in the process, is there one that comes before the other, or are they intertwined? You know, do you start with the feeling, or do you start with that imagery?
I don't think I begin with either one. I just start, you know, I begin writing a scene. You know, three people are sitting down at a breakfast table, you know, in Peru, you know, and I just know if I keep writing, something's going to happen. You know, and actually, I don't think about the imagery. I don't think about, in the first draft, I don't think about any of those things. And I tend not to think about the imagery or even my voice. You know, that's invisible to me. So what I want to do is get the most complicated scene in the clearest way on the page, or not complicated for the sake of being complicated, but the most intimate scene, perhaps. And then gradually, you know,
a girl walks into a barn and she sees her sister lying on the ground, and then a horse comes in, and suddenly you've got three things going on simultaneously. But also she's remembering it from much later on, so there's that element that's kind of layering the thing. And I think it's to do for me with, you know, I'm not trying to make things complicated, but I think things are layered. You know, I think if I just describe a scene where someone walks into a pizza parlor, has a pizza and goes out, that's fine, I have no problems with that, but if it's gonna be in the book for a long time, something else has to be happening, you know, subliminally or subconsciously, or that this is his seventh pizza in the book, you know, which would say something, you know.
And I would say very briefly, because I know we're running out of time, that I start from images, yes, and then and then I move towards sound. Sound and rhythm. So it's a different process. And this is the funny thing about like teaching writing and creative writing programs is that like everybody will have a different answer. And that's the magic and the mystery of the process of writing.
We're running out of time to listen to you now, but not the desire to listen to you. We wish it could go on for a very long time. And so you have left us hungry, which is a wonderful feeling. Thank you so much. Right-hand side here, 192 books, so please come and purchase your book of Michael Ondaatje and Colin McCann. Thanks a lot.